Mahon Bukal. David D, everybody.
Well, I'll take off the jumper for this, Mark. The
Called the Ganzi.
Guernsey. Thanks, Mark. Hi, everybody. I remember, I can't remember who it was, but they were asked who they were. And I always remember it was, I am that I am who I am. I like that. And my good friend Roger, who is in Akron, Ohio, and he's in Ground Central, and he likes to introduce himself. I'm a person in recovery. So today is really special for me, like 25 years sober, and it's great that I can celebrate it with my AA family, because I walked into an AA room with into a meeting, because I had reached the end of the road inside myself. There was no place for me to go after my last drink, and I went to my doctor, and I told him I was in serious trouble, and he gave me 2 days Librium, and I went home, and then he put me in contact with an addiction counseling center. I went up there, but in the meantime, I walked into an AA meeting, and Martina, the only person who I thought I knew would be in AA, she was the first person I saw when I opened the door. She says, "Hi, Dave. You're welcome. We were wondering when you'd get here." I thought, like, what does she mean? Had they got me on a list? And it was like the first time AA started messing with my head. And when I got in, very quickly, I identified as being an alcoholic, because it was right there beside me. And over the years, I always identified with being an alcoholic. Where now I'm looking at, I'm, you see, those first few years, the alcoholism was just there behind me. It was so close. I was moving away from it. And AA gave me the ground to stand on that I could do that. But like I see now, what I'm moving towards always is transformation. And that's what recovery does for me. It allows me to be transformed and to transform myself. And today is bittersweet for me. It's sweet because when I walked into my first AA meeting, I never imagined I'd be 25 years from now. Today, this is where I'd be. And I'm really sad that I don't have my wife, Nikki, with me. Nikki died last June, and it's just, I'm broken my heart. And I'm so sad. And if there was anything and everything I had that I could give to have her here beside me now, but it's not possible. She's in here, in my heart. I don't really know what I'm going to say tonight. I didn't write to sit down and plan anything. What's the secret? In that little drawing you did for me, Mark, with the tree and the triangle. I've mentioned that several times before in meetings about the service, unity, and recovery. And that tree, my surname is Donlan, and my family crest has an oak tree. Without any foreground, so you have the branches, the trunk, and the roots. And what seems to be a dark person chained to the tree, but if you look at it very closely, there's no lock on the chain. It's a passive chaining. And in Irish mythology, the oak tree was always a symbol of knowledge. And it's like my family, that crest is recognizing that we're seekers of knowledge. And of course, the oak is really important in Irish folklore. And you know, there's on Derry, it's called after the oak tree. There's, you know, so that was lovely to see the tree. And my recovery, what did I do? And I call this, I suppose I recognized best practice from the very beginning. And the things I do regularly is I go to meetings, I involved in service, and I try and do my best to be honest with myself and with the world around me. And today was just a very ordinary day. You know, this is a day beyond my wildest dreams because I got to work in the morning. I went shopping in the afternoon. I had my first grief counseling therapy today. And then I managed to cook myself a lovely chicken stir fry with noodles. And I've also cooked tomorrow's dinner because I'm work, you know, it's a similar thing tomorrow. I'm working tomorrow. So I thought, yeah, I'll do a nice black bean and vegetable curry. And I'm at a meeting and I'm going to get an, you know, unusual. I'm going to get another meeting after this. And that's it. That's a day. That's a life beyond my wildest dreams. No drama, no hiccups. While I was cooking and eating my dinner, I was listening to Miles Davis, you know, having a little bop in the kitchen. You know, I'm a legend in my own kitchen. And it was just so, you know, with my natural family, this couldn't be celebrated. They wouldn't be able for it. Where with my A family, it is the case. I can celebrate. And my life has changed unbelievably. I'm soon the scales is going to be tipping quite soon in that I'll be longer sober than when I was than drinking. Another 2 years, I'll be at that point where I'll have longer sobriety than my drinking life. And you know, I was alcoholic at 13. I got drunk when I was younger, actually, and I started using drugs about 15, and that stopped at 39. And at 39, I'd lost everything. You know, I'd lost my first marriage, lost my home, lost my job, lost. I was actually in the process of losing my sanity because I wanted the psychiatric services to take me in. I thought it would be a good idea because I knew. I used to work in a hospital in the psychiatric, so I said, geez, they've got great drugs. They knock people out, you know. I get to do the soft shoe shuffle, and kind of, and then I started thinking about, nah, none of this is worth it. I think I could just maybe end my life. There's nothing worth living for. And after my last binge, I was just so full of this awful feeling towards myself, of feeling an utter failure, an utter fuck up. And all the excuses I used to have, mostly which was pointing away from myself, blaming my life, blaming other people, blaming my family, you know. Here was a poor, at the time, it was my wife, and then became my ex-wife, blaming her. Like, here was a woman at home with two kids, and I was out drinking and drugging. And she'd ask, you know, she'd want to know where I was and was I coming home. And I was blaming her And the last drink, the last drunk was the time I ran out of being able to blame anybody or anything. And I, first time ever, I took the mirror and I turned it around and I looked at myself. And I thought, Jesus, I'm in trouble here. And it was the first little, like Leonard Cohen said, the light got into the crack and it started to illuminate some of those dark areas. And my doctor was the first person, because I considered it a medical issue. And my doctor, I got honest with my doctor. And interestingly, what he gave me 2 days oblivion. He gave me drugs to go home so I could calm down after my drinking. Kind of calm. He says, "Yeah, after 2 days, come back to me and we'll have another chat." And I said to my friend Brian, because he's just sent me something this morning, that it was 9,131 days sober. But the interesting one was 920,404,800 heartbeats of sober. And like every one of those heartbeats is precious. And when I came into AA, I remember, it was meeting Martina, getting a cup of tea, and very quickly feeling, Jesus, these people are talking. I can understand this. I know this, but this makes sense. And then after a while, I managed to lift my head up and I heard people talking about the steps and I started looking at these charts on the wall and I went, oh, fucking hell. Look, there's all this God and higher power fucking shit. What am I walking into? And lucky enough, I met somebody. I met two good. They were guides. I met one man. He said, "Look, Dave, don't worry about it. Think of all that as just a force for good." And then I met somebody else, Aidan, who became. He actually became because Aidan, like myself, being cross addicted, he was in NA as well. But I hadn't gone to NA at this stage. And he said to me about. He said, "Don't worry about it, Dave. Actually, take the steps off the wall. Forget about them up on the wall and bring them into your heart." And it kind of made sense. I said, oh, so this is a heart-based program. This has to do with the heart. And then I heard the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I mean, that connects. Desire comes from the heart. This is my heart wanting me to change my life, wanting to live rather than the slow death I was going through, and contemplating a quick death, contemplating checking out in despair. I thought, yeah, this is, but how do I deal with the God thing? And I thought, well, really, there's no game in town. I was going to this day program for about 6 weeks. And the counselors were saying, and people were saying, you can stay sober for a while, Dave, and there's going to be aftercare, but long term, you really need to be going to AA. And I made that commitment. I made the commitment from the get go. I was going to take this seriously, as best as I could. Because I realize now that my life depended on it. But I also, it was coming from my heart. It was coming from, I remember sitting at the end of a bar stool or in a party wanting a drink or a drug and not having this insatiable hunger to consume more. And I'd get to a point in that consumption where I would pass out if I was lucky. I just had this awful capacity for taking huge amounts of drink and drugs. to run away from myself and to run away from the pain I was feeling about me and about my life. And now I was in AA and I was beginning to feel good because I was sober. I wasn't creating any more chaos. That felt good by itself. I still didn't feel good about myself, discovered I my very low opinion of myself just didn't vanish. But at least being sober, I was given an opportunity where I could begin to get an idea of who I was. And of course, being quite an empty vessel, one of the addiction counselors, they were Jack and Joe. I used to call them Jack and Jill. They were like hard cop, soft cop. They were a great double act. And Jack said to me, Dave, you've got a good mind. You should consider, going to college for yourself. And so within a year in recovery, I was signed up for a nighttime pre-university course. And, I remember I used to say, yes, I went off to university because I saw God on the 12 steps, and I needed to figure out all about this God. So the best place for me to do it was university. But the truth of the matter was that in Ireland, I was lucky, really lucky, that not alone did I get my fees paid for, the state actually gave me some living money to live on. So I got paid to do a degree. And of course, early recovery, I milked this for all it was worth. So rather than doing 3 years, I did 5 years BA international degree. I did my pre-university, my first year. Halfway through first year, I was so riddled with fear and perfectionism, I pulled out. I had this irrational fear of doing exams. I pulled out, fell off the horse, got back up, because again, there was no other game in town for me. I always ran away. This was something, I'm not running away. I'm going to face my fears. I really detested being examined. And I went back and changed all my subjects, did a second first year, and then did a second year. And then there was an open competition for two places for two students in Boston College in Massachusetts. I didn't know anything about Boston College in Massachusetts, but it sounded good. So I applied, and to make a long story short, as we say here, I was one of the students picked to go to Boston College. And from an academic perspective, it was like academic heaven. But then the university came back to me, and I told them that the only reason I was going to Boston was that there was no place in Europe that would teach my subjects through English, and I was doing classics and philosophy because this was the root, the foundation, Western civilization, the Greeks and the Romans. I always had a thing about the Romans, the Roman army, and the Greeks. What was his name? He did the animation of Jason and the Argonauts. I remember that movie. Was it 1970s, 60s? Fascinated by. So that's why I wanted to do classics. And they said, okay, Dave, we'll get back to you on that. And they said, oh, yeah, just before I signed up to go off to Boston, we would like to send some students to Malta. And of course, Malta, is, a lot of classical temples and architecture, and Malta's in the Mediterranean. And December in the Mediterranean is quite pleasant. December in Boston is a bit cold. And my head wanted to go to Boston, but my heart wanted to go to the Med, go to Malta. So I followed my heart. That's what brought me into AA. It hasn't done me any harm. So I went off to Malta for a year. And so what was happening in my in by staying sober, suddenly I was getting all these choices. I was even allowed, in a way, to fail. That's what I was doing, because I was self-sabotaging. I didn't know any different. I was either I had to be perfect or I had to be the bottom. And it was a hard journey for me to learn to be somewhere in the middle. And I went off to Malta. I got help in the university, and I went off to Malta, and then I came back to do my degree. So that was like 5 years. And for the first time ever, I thought, I'm going to go and put the effort in to be the best. And if anybody, I don't know if you would remember this, Mark, but 60s education in Ireland was absolutely brutal. It was there was huge amounts of physical violence. I don't know, was it in your time, but my experience of education was horrendous. And now I was becoming self-directed, and this was running parallel with what was happening in my recovery, in that I was working with Aidan. I got he became not alone my NA sponsor, but he came out my housemate and my buddy. And I got a handle on the whole notion of addiction. It wasn't just alcoholism, it was addiction I had to deal with. And that happened like I was maybe 3 and 4 months in AA, and I went back smoking dope. Still going to AA meetings, rationalized away that, it was alcohol that was the problem. What the heck? A bit of dope is no harm. But I soon copped on. I went a couple of months of that, and it was just wasn't working. So again, I went back to my addiction counselor. Again, I got real and I got honest. And he put me on a couple of, there was a couple of months I was on anti-booze, and told me I had to come, within 24-hour notice, I had to come up and provide urine samples just to prove that I wasn't. And I took that seriously. Because now I had, and I by the time I'm finished my degree, I got what it was I was looking for. I put in the work, and for the first time ever in my educational life, I get a prize. I get the highest marks. I get a double first in philosophy and classics. And I get not alone this kind of plaque, and there was something else. They also get me a prize. I love getting money prizes. I love getting paid. So they give me money for being good. Imagine that. The state gave me money to be educated at a third level. They paid for my degree, and then they gave me money for doing good. I thought, people might criticize the Irish state, but in some ways it's way ahead. And then I went ahead and I did a postgraduate work. I did a master's, and I was on my way to doing a PhD, and tragedy strikes my life and the life of my family, that my eldest son, Luke, died at 24 from a drug overdose. And his girlfriend was pregnant at the time, and my darling granddaughters were born. They're now 15. And at Luke's wake, all his friends were up there, and there was a lot of drink and drugs. And one of the young lads handed me a bottle and said, "Hey, would you like a drink, Dave?" And I said, "No, thanks. I'm not drinking." And they said, "What? You're not drinking for your son's funeral?" I said, "No. Not alone am I not drinking, I don't want to drink." So before I knew, this was like, I'm now a decade in. I'm now 10 years in recovery. I've accomplished all this, and here this big tragedy, the worst nightmare of any parent. And what did I do? I went to the house, was one of the first there, and my son was dead on the floor, and I hold him and cradle him. And he was already dead for a while, still warm. And what do I do? And the talk came into my head, you go to a meeting, Dave. That's the only thing you can do. Because anything else is, if I picked up a drink or a drug, what would result would be not would be absolute mayhem. A part of me wanted to take a photograph in that house of the guys who sold them the heroin. They thought, I'll sort these lads out. And I know people who will sort these lads out. Nobody's getting out of this house without paying a cost for my son's death. And I had to deep that, you know, as my son was laying on the, laid out on the floor, and the paramedics had left, and the police, the detectives were there. This was thoughts running through my head. And sometimes the slogans work and sometimes they don't. But I remember think, and I'll, Jesus, think this through now, Dave. If you go through with this, what's going to happen? So what I ended up doing was I left the house, went across the road and bought a packet of cigarettes. I hadn't smoked nicotine in a long, long, you know, a couple of years, and I went back smoking nicotine. And it was like I still hadn't fully learned. The cigarette now was a way I could punish myself. And I think it was about another 6 years before I could fully quit the nicotine again. So that was a bit of self-harming. And I didn't take the photograph of the lads in the house, and I didn't make the, and I actually got in, I actually was told, Dave, you just put the names on a piece of paper. You have nothing to worry about. This will be sorted for you. And I actually had to tell people, no, I don't want anything sorted. I don't want anything done. In fact, it's the complete opposite, because Luke's mum, my ex-wife, her, such a compassionate woman, thought all those guys in that house needed help. They didn't need what I was thought would be a response. And of course, then Kayla and Kelsey were born, and they came into our lives, and Nikki and I had them every weekend, and they were pure joy. And recently it was their birthday. November, it was 15, was their birthday, and I was always there for the birthday, and I always brought them out and bought them stuff, clothes or whatever. Usually clothes now, the last couple of years, and they were putting on these items of clothing which were like Band-Aids, you know. And I said, so I go, is your mother going to let you wear that? Kayla kind of looked at me and go, Granddad, listen, you've nothing to worry about. Just bring your credit card and we'll do the rest. And I thought, fair enough. So like I was showing my age, so they're like, here they are, young women. And but after Luke was, that's where I went. Yes, I had to get out, so I help, and but I kept close to AA. I kept close to my heart, and my life changed. The direction of my life utterly changed. I didn't go back to finish my PhD. I managed to knock another 5 years out of university. I was tutoring there and working. And I had met Nikki just before Luke died. That was 16 years ago, and our relationship developed. And I was applying for another job within the university. Nikki and I had we'd gone off to Australia for a year, and we were in Spain for a while. And I was applying for another job within the university. She said, Dave, I'd love if you would come and help me look after my dad, because her mom had died the year before. We were in Australia and planning to go back there to stay. And she said, I wouldn't, I'd never forgive myself if anything happened to my dad. I want to be able to look after him. So I said, okay, I'll go with you. So we up sticks, left here, left the west of Ireland, off to England. And our lives take another turn, and I keep getting closer. I keep falling in love with this wonderful woman, and eventually I got up the courage to ask her to marry me. And she agreed, and we got married just after COVID. And our plans was that, our future was, we were heading off to New Zealand because Nikki had a New Zealand passport. Now, being her spouse, I could apply for a status. That's where we were heading. and Nicky went for a hysterectomy, and the surgeon discovered the bowel tumor, and it didn't. The chemotherapy didn't work. The treatment didn't work. So after 3 months, the cancer had spread. The metastasis had spread to the rest of her body and her brain. So decided no more intervention, and the surgeon told us 6 months. That was Christmas last year, and Nikki died on the 8th of May, and all that time. I stopped working. I was with her the whole time. Walked with her the whole way, right up, and I held her hand when she took her last breath. And that woman never saw me drink or drug. And she loved me. And I learned from her love that I could begin to love myself. And that's the journey of my recovery. It's about self-love and self-compassion. I had to create something in order to love it. It was already there, but I'd lost sight of it. But now, as an adult, I needed to create. And I in early recovery, that's what I was. I was a student, and then I was a tutor, and then I was in admin. So I had all these identifiers. This is what I was, but really, the biggest one was that I was loved by this wonderful woman. That's what mattered the most. And she loved me when I couldn't love myself fully. And she, I respect, you know, it was wonderful. Like sometimes Nikki would just turn to me and say, "Dave, when was the last time you had a meeting?" And I go, "Fuck, I'm behaving like a bollocks, am I?" And she says, No, just wondering, like." And I know it was her way of saying, "Go off and get yourself sorted out, will you? Go to a meeting." And she said it so lovely and so gentle. And things changed. After with her dying, particularly towards the end, and after her death, had to leave the house at the family home. Things became very difficult, and because I hadn't been at work for 9 months, the company let me go. So I lost my wife, I lost my home, I lost my job. And lucky enough, some friends took me in the village. Lovely family, and their three kids, and the children, like the youngest lad, it was two and a bit. There was a huge garden, a huge house, and you know, within AA traditions, it's, you know, to be self-supporting, fully self-supporting. So no money was being asked of me. You know, I was offered, I was given what I needed, which was a loving household that I could hold myself in, that could hold me after losing Nikki. And what the youngest lad, we became buddies. And I used to go out into the, you know, to return the kindness given to me. I did work for my friends. I looked after their garden, and there was a big gardening project. And the youngest boy, Arlo, he, you know, I had my big wheelbarrow, he had his little wheelbarrow. We both had gloves, and he had his little Wellingtons. And I'd come down in the morning, you know, and he's waiting. He go, "Dave," this big smile, "Dave." And all he wanted was out in the garden. "Let's go, Dave." And he's handing me my shoes and my gloves. And he was just giving me pure love. Absolutely no conditions, unconditional love. And it was then I decided to come back to Galway. And the last couple of years, But certainly, well, it's really at the beginning of COVID, my recovery took on a new outlook, because when the meeting, when physical meetings stopped, I started looking online, and I came across Secular A, and particularly this Sober Without God, really influenced by the secular approach of Geoffrey Munn. And that became my home group. That's where I'm going at 8 o'clock tonight. And my whole that's where I'm at. That for me is the only game in town. And I had there was a lot of there was some crazy shit done by family towards me. And I know they're suffering and they're in grief, but it doesn't explain the behavior. But it resulted in me, I got an awful lot of anger. And this is I need to be able to express my anger, but I have to do it healthily. So, I've been trying to work different ways of doing it. But I also know that once I began to access that anger, that it becomes the gateway to something else that I have to go beyond. Like, what's beyond recovery? What's beyond AA? It doesn't become the end point for me. And I'm drawn, it brings me, I didn't know this. I didn't want this. I wanted to go back and cause physical harm to people. Like the reaction after Luke died, I wanted to make sure these people paid for what happened, which is a very narrow viewpoint. And, when I looked inside, when I looked at my heart, that doesn't work, Dave. So there has to be something else. And I started working with a mask, and I made this kind of horrible, angry mask. And the mask became my outwardly way of getting angry of and hiding behind it, but it allowed me as a channel to access what do I need with my anger. And the word came back, compassion. So I have to start working towards compassion, even when I don't feel compassionate. It's easy for me to be grateful when everything is going right, to be grateful when everything is going fucking belly up. And I had to develop little tricks for myself, like, how do I get into tomorrow when I hate, and then, well, not hate, sorry, that's wrong. I have a lot of discomfort at nighttime, particularly going to bed. I haven't slept for a year and a half, really. I wake up quite often during the night. My sleeping is very disturbed. And I don't, it's not dread going to bed, but it's like, But I do have something, and I love reading, and my first genre was science fiction. So I love going into space in bed. And I can get to sleep, but I will wake up through the night. And I thought, I'll work on this, but I also need to have a little act. I need to, the symbolism of doing something to give me hope for tomorrow. So what I do now is I have this little cup, and I fill it with oats, and I soak my porridge the night before. And that's my stepping stone into tomorrow. That's my act of hope for tomorrow. And that's what I need, because I feel very alone in some ways. And I feel I think, fuck, do I have to go through this again? And it's like, shit, man, I have no explanation for it. I don't believe in anything beyond reality. There's nothing personal in any of this. This is just fucking bad luck. This is life happening. This is what it's like in recovery. Shit happens. What do I do when shit happens? And the one and what is it I don't do? Well, what I don't do is I don't pick up. And what I do is I go to, like I'm here tonight, I go to my connectedness. I go to my family, my AA family. And I say, I'm Dave. This is me. I'm an alcoholic. And this is what's happening. This is what's going on in my life. And this is what I'm trying to do with it. This is what I'm trying to work with what's happening in my life. And I'm being guided by something I learned in this connectedness. The 12 steps are signposts. They point me in a direction. They tell me, this is the way to go, Dave. This is now figure it out. You know, I don't have to figure out the 12 steps. I don't have to figure out the direction. You can imagine you go into a city you've never been or go to a place you've never been. And the first thing I start doing if I'm looking for places is I look up at the signposts and I see sometimes there's an image of the thing I want. If I'm in Paris and it's the Eiffel Tower and there's a signpost with the image of the Eiffel Tower, that's the way I have to go. That's the direction if I want to get to the Eiffel Tower. And all these signposts, the 12 steps, the meetings, the slogans, all these things, they all point me in a direction. And the direction is towards my heart, always. I can get sideways, you know, I can go off into a side street and I go into my head. And but eventually I'll come back. I'll come back here to this. Because that's the most precious. My recovery, which is my heart, is the most precious thing I have. You know, it's where I come from now. And I'm very grateful to AA. You know, I know the two guys who started off were two egomaniacs in some ways, and I like the group I'm in, the Just for Today. Sorry, the Sober Without God. You know, it's a 12-step. I've always gone to 12-step meetings. I love the secular approach. I love the idea of, yeah, I'm responsible now. This is on me, and I need help, and I'm prepared to work for it. And you know, as a group. We form study, you know, for new people. There's no individual sponsorship. The group becomes the sponsor. And we run Geoffrey Munn's workbook. So there's no ego in here. It's the group and the group responsibility and the principles and the signposts, and we're all going in the one direction. We help each other. It's like, I know this is an online forum, but if we were in a room now, we'd all be sitting around in a circle and I'd be part of the circle. I'm part of something. Not alone am I, you know, am I part of something in my own life? I'm part of something beyond my own life that also feeds back into me. I'm in this positive feedback loop. My drinking, my drugging and my low esteem and how I felt about myself were all feeding the opposite way. And my recovery takes that and turns that energy the other way and gives me the opportunity where I can start to feel good about myself, that I can live with the pain I'm in. I can live with the agony and the loss, and it's not going to kill me. How long have I been talking for Jesus? For God's sake. That's the worst about, you know, you give me a chat. This is what I like about the sub meetings, you know, 15 minutes, and the secretary will say, would you shut up now, Dave? Where I've been going on and on and on, and I don't know really, you know, it doesn't matter. Thank you. Thank you for being here tonight to help me celebrate. You know, thank you for bringing the message to me. And Thank you for showing me the love, and particularly at the times where I couldn't love myself. Well, I get all emotional now. Well, just thank you. And thank you, A, for being the vehicle that allowed me to get my life back, to have a life. And I like this, a life, progressive life, where how I grow inside and what I am as a person is more important than all the things or those external identifiers. If they come my way, well and good. If they don't, it doesn't matter. It's how I feel about myself. And that's my recovery. So I'm going to leave it at that. Sorry for going on for so long.